Well, we vowed not to cover it this week, but it's reared its ugly head once again.
That's right, dratted MPs' expenses.
And Cameron and his relationship with Europe. You know, some subjects mature like an old Stilton.
To cut through the Gorgonzola this week, we have two of our colleagues. Catherine Bennett for the first time in Studio One from The Observer. Hello, Catherine.
Hi.
And Politics Weekly regular, Jackie.
Hello.
Jackie, something that caught your eye was Gabby Hinsliff's piece on Sunday.
Yeah, I was actually very saddened by that because
the political editor of The Observer
has just quit, basically because she can't manage it. There's not enough time, she said. And I felt very sad because I joined the Westminster lobby more than 20 years ago as one of very few women when it was sort of almost impossible for a woman to work there. And over the years, I saw more and more women coming in, more and more getting top jobs, actually, political editors. And what I've seen over the last 5 years is they're all disappearing off again. Now, I think there's something wrong with the system. Gabby's own personal story, I dare say, is one of between her and her boss at The Observer. I don't particularly want to go into that, but I think it's a shame that there was not a way of working out somehow that a woman could do that job, because I think it should still be possible.
Catherine, did you bristle at 3 pages?
Well, that's not my decision, but I wasn't totally sympathetic to the thrust of the thing, because when I compare being a journalist and a parent to the lot of quite a lot of my friends who aren't journalists but who are parents, I think lots of other jobs are infinitely harder to combine with a family. They're much less flexible. You know, you can't write at home. You know, there are ways of doing journalism, e.g. being part-time or doing a bit less of it, which, you know, I'm probably very lazy, but I am part-time. And I don't say yes to possibly as many things that some other journalists do. Mm. And I think it is manageable to have a family.
But Allegra, do you think
dreading this.
No, I'm just going to say, do you think there's a specific thing with the lobby? Because there's journalism on the one hand where people might write pieces and
staffed by
plan
political
them.
Junkies.
And then there's the political
people
junkies.
People can't say no because, apart from recess, or in fact not even during recess, there's always some press conference going on somewhere.
But
it's something
you can
that
turn
it's
off?
Something. There are two different issues. It's something that affects men as much as women. There are marriages that break down in the lobby because of this sense on the participants' part that it's kind of you never really turn off, and that's just the sort of person that's attracted to the job in the first place. But it's all professions, isn't it? You have to forcibly encourage a change of
Westminster culture. Politics is really important because I think part of this whole disconnect that we'll come onto with the expenses is that you have this little group of people who work at Westminster who are very cliquey. The lobby remains incredibly cliquey. You're either
by
one of the boys
or
not. You give your life to it or you don't. You socialise with them. You do not then have a proper life outside. You don't tend to mix with other people outside. And you focus on the MPs and you have this little world that no one really understands apart from those who are in it. And I think that's a very bad thing.
And it does affect the stories you write.
Well, let's cast up our eyes from Westminster to the continent as a whole and look to David Cameron and his cast iron guarantee of a referendum on the EU and how it rusted away. Yesterday, he attempted to appease his furious Eurosceptic colleagues by promising to repatriate some powers from Brussels instead.
We will make sure that this never, ever happens again. Never again should it be possible for a British government to transfer power to the European Union without the say of the British people in a referendum. If we win the next election, we will amend the European Communities Act 1972 to prohibit, by law, the transfer of power to the European Union without a referendum. Never again.
Allegra, you're on the front page of our paper today telling the world what the French think of the Tories just now.
Reporting. It's a brilliant story. The French Europe Minister, we interviewed him last night and he just came tumbling from his lips. And he's a diplomat on the record saying that the Tories are being autistic in sort of so many words. And they've castrated the UK's influence.
It's brilliant because I think it's welcome to power, David Cameron, because on the one hand, he's got Europe slagging him off. And on the other, he's got Dan Hannam, his outspoken anti-European Euro MP and a lot of his backbenchers. And so I think he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I don't think this is one that's going to go away either, for all that he's hoping it is.
Well, I think maybe it's quite clever, though, because actually he's not going to have a referendum, but all the kind of Euro or sceptic rage about that is going to be slightly kind of dissipated by their glee of being hated by the French.
I mean,
maybe it's quite good because it makes him look terribly anti-Europe without actually having to do anything apart from sit there and take insults from a horrible Frenchman.
So my enemy's enemies are my friends kind of thing.
And castrated. I mean, I think it's probably...
So you think he'll be...
I can see your logic, but then isn't there a slight problem here in terms of the kind of what Cameron used to call the aroma of the Conservative Party turning into a stench? Because when people who aren't bothered about Europe in Middle England see, you know, the connections with the Latvian extremists and the Polish people, and then these kind of sensible-looking people in ties in France coming on the telly and sort of bad-mouthing him, does it make him look a bit less savoury, do you think?
Well, that may be balanced by the fact there isn't going to be a referendum, and actually everybody knows you can't do a thing about anything for years. Mm. So in practical terms, all this is just noise, isn't it? Makes no difference.
Yeah, but I think also he will lose a lot of votes to UKIP now, because I think everyone knows it is nothing, this sort of, oh, I won't let things happen in future. So I think UKIP will actually take quite a lot of votes come the next election.
And do you think, Jackie, when we move into the Parliament itself, assuming the Conservatives win, he set out this shopping list of things that he's going to get back? The French are telling us now through this interview that they don't think they're going to let him have any such powers back at all. Is it going to be a running sore, or do you think, like, this is just something he's got to get through and then it will be forgotten
about?
No, you
see, if he's going to do anything about it at all, we have to have rows. And then, you know, the Europeans say, OK, we'll take your rebate back. And so that does become a big story. But the thing is, for many, many Conservatives, Europe is the biggest issue. It's the biggest issue of all for them. So they're not going to let it die down. So I think Cameron cannot just say, I'll kick this into the long grass and in due course I will try and do something about powers. It will keep coming back. People like Dan Hannum, people like David Davis, they're going to keep the pressure up. So you will have to do something. And he will then run into big trouble with the Europeans. And then we're going to get into this in or out. I mean, a lot of people in Europe are saying, never mind all this, you're either in or you're out. And David Cameron desperately does not want that argument.
Catherine, does he speak for the British people? Or is this a very internal debate and slightly detached?
I think it's a generational thing, possibly. I think maybe he doesn't speak for lots of younger British people who don't really have a problem with it and don't understand why, you know, people, the Tories still go on about it. But I think maybe... I mean, I think maybe the Tories generally, even the very, very sort of Europhobic ones, want to win the election more than they want to get out of Europe right now. So I think maybe, I think it's quite cunning. I think he might be able to just carry on saying horrid things and people be horrid back to him, but just carry on really basically having the project which is winning the election, and it'll go away for a few years.
But does it, Catherine's sort of talking about it as a sort of super election, sort of supra election thing, but does it actually play within the general election, Catherine?
Well, I think it will, because if you look at the Tory papers, they're all furious with him. Mm. If you listen to most of his MPs, they're all furious with him. And yes, they want power, and it may be a lot of them will sort of bite their lip until afterwards, but it's not going to make it very easy for him. And I think people are already saying, oh, this marvellous, new, clean, nice Tory party that we thought was going to come in and be much better than mouldy old Labour. It's actually full of splits and tensions, and hang on a minute, we're not so sure about them after all.
I mean, it sort of felt that the momentous press conference, etc., it sort of felt like this was a big test of his leadership, and he may well not necessarily have passed it, but you guys think he did pass it?
No, I think you're right. I think he didn't, because
even if it was too... So the sort of fine-tuning point...
I think maybe for Tories he has, possibly. Mm. I certainly don't think he's put anyone off, and I'm not so sure about the UKIP thing. I mean, for pathetic people like me, I think it's really depressing. And I think his approach, their approach to Europe is lunatic, really, and quite scary. Because it's so unformed, isn't it, really? It's just hostile and stupid. So, but I mean, you know, I might be expected not to like what he says about anything very much anyway.
You ain't the target.
For more on this debate and to have your say on it, visit the Comment is Free section of The Guardian's website.
When MPs wanted to cleanse their expenses regime, they handed control to someone outside the House, the former civil servant Sir Christopher Kelly. That was 5 months ago, and he finally reported on Thursday. But handing away power doesn't always go well, as Alan Johnson found out when he had to sack his drugs advisor. Anne Perkins walks us through the problems of the powerful giving away power.
I think two things are happening when governments talk about giving power away, or indeed giving power to experts. There's a general perception that government's too powerful, that it tries to do too much, and that people are too far away from the decisions that influence their own lives, and that they're disengaged from the whole political process. So obviously, governments of all political persuasions are promising to give power back to people. The trouble is that against that urge, there's an equally powerful urge not to be caught out when things go wrong. So governments desperately want to keep hold of power. So as Aaron Bevan said in the 1940s when he was setting up the National Health Service, he wanted to hear a bedpan drop in the corridors of Whitehall. And it's that conflicting tension which is behind both the urge to centralise and the desire to give power away. the decision to use these expert advisors, in a way, is an admission by politicians that they can't do everything and that they don't have the expertise, for example, to understand fully what's happening in the world of drug use and abuse. Similarly, the desire to set up a completely independent parliamentary standards authority that will set MPs' expenses and police them, and indeed, if Kelly has implemented fully, their pay as well, then that is an admission that people don't trust them anymore, and therefore they're trying to bolster their credibility and their authority by going outside the normal circles. And you see it more and more. You see it when politicians try and get soldiers to support defence policy, or police, for example, to back increasing terms of detention. All the time, politicians are looking for external and apparently independent voices that will support their cause. And it's a very dubious route to go down.
Is it dubious, Jackie Brown? Is it dubious?
No, I mean, I think the trouble with these independent advisers is if they're really independent, they are going to say things you don't like. And I think politicians are rather naive, actually, if they go into this without sort of thinking about what the outcome is going to be. I mean, I think it is a fairly cynical exercise when you take on these independent people, because you're trying to give it a veneer of respectability to a decision that you don't think you can take by yourself.
But wasn't there a particular problem with Nutt, the deliciously named Professor Nutt? Wasn't there a problem? Because the question is, was there a problem? He'd been writing too many op-eds, hadn't he?
Well, yes, but I think you can't take people on and expect them to be utterly neutered either. I mean, you're not saying you come into the political system and you therefore take collective cabinet responsibility and everything. So I think you just have to let them do what they do. And if he's going to be outspoken, yes. But I mean, in the first place, if you're having that kind of review, surely it wouldn't be rocket science to work out what the kind of review was going to come up with. You just ask a few friendly scientists and then you'd have to think, what the political implications of that? I mean, I think they've been very naive in the way they've gone about this.
Catherine, was Johnson wrong to?
Completely naive. I mean, I think also if he hadn't done this sacking, people would have forgotten about it. I don't think people are that stupid. They don't have a problem with the idea that scientific advice isn't always going to be taken, that it might not be politic, that you might wait a bit. I mean, kinds of ways they could have finessed that. And in fact, if they just sort of taken his comments, it would have looked quite broad-minded and, you know, sort of sophisticated, wouldn't it? Or sensible, anyway. And there are all kinds of arguments why they could justify that not taking his advice. But to sack him has just made him...
Well, it's happened before over cannabis, hasn't it? They've had scientific advice, but both Blunkett and Charles Clarke ignored the scientists. But, you know, I think people accept that. The scientists say something, the politicians say, well, thank you very much, we accept your scientific advice, but there are wider questions, like the political questions.
I think there's a particular...
By the way,
problem.
Tom used to work for Alan Johnson.
Oh, yes, the inside track.
Yes. And then he sacked you.
Yeah, no, I was cast out. No, but on the ACMD, I think there was a problem brewing. I think that because they've been ignored now 3 times in a row, and of course, rationality, in a way, you can argue, as we argued in the editorials this week, has been ignored for kind of 40 straight years, really, in the war on drugs. So in that sense, it's nothing new. But the government has made more of a habit recently of asking the ACMD for advice. And the ACMD's made more of a habit of saying, we want to give some advice ourselves. So it's been ignored now on ecstasy, on cannabis, and on magic mushrooms. It wasn't even asked 3 times in quick succession. And there is a limit to how far you can ask experts to kind of say, we're treated respectfully, it's good to be part of the tent once or twice, but push it too far, and then I think they'll walk out. And I think that's kind of what's happened. That's why Nutt took such an abrasive tone, I think.
But what's the answer? Not to have these scientists at all? Or to maybe to take their advice in a less public way?
Well, I think
call them in for quite a cup of coffee.
I think it's one of the two, isn't it? You've got to decide. You can't have it both ways, which is what the government really is left looking like it does want to do.
But not that many of them actually have resigned, have they? Well, at the beginning, he was saying everyone's going to resign. Yeah. And if they had all resigned, you might think there's a problem. But actually, three. I don't know how many more scientists there are out there, but you suspect enough.
I think more might, because so Nutt went, and then two went in sympathy, and the rest of them got told they could have a meeting with Johnson, and then they're saying the meetings
are going
well. But
these are from the same body, rather than sort of John Beddington et al., all of the other advisers across Whitehall.
Yeah, it's a question about whether this one body can survive, but it is a body that was set up in the 70s and has been there for a long time. They need to change the law to get rid of it.
Beddington didn't criticise the sacking, did he?
No.
But let's just bring it back from drugs for a minute to expenses. Like, again, this was another idea of having an expert in, he'll sort it all out for us and we won't need to worry about it ourselves. Is your perception, Catherine, that that's worked at all?
Well, I think it's worked brilliantly because it's been so fantastically enjoyable and it carries on being enjoyable. And I find that, you know, the protestations just make it even more marvellous. But
spectator sport rather than the dignity of democracy.
I think it has worked. And I think I know that people who defend the MP's conduct say it's not fair. And I think actually these men have said that whatever, you know, most people wanted them to say is they don't care whether they're sort of really got a sort of mandate behind them or they're democratically elected. I think the only annoying thing is that a guy who they've appointed to head IPSA is going to be paid $100,000 for 3 days' work or something. I mean, that was a bit dark.
It was terrible because it was real booby on John Bercow's part because it's capped at 100 grand. And he's £700 a day, which is a lot of money. But it was this in that house when they announced this. It was everybody. It sort of was evidence of how
cross they all are about
it. They were
really
cross, but they were all kind of sort of in the kind of surreal mode because they all started laughing. It was just uproarious laughter. But
a sort of anti-politics conspiracy.
No, well, the first thing is that I think that a lot of MPs feel that Kelly wasn't as bad as it could have been. Mm. And actually, this was a case of the leaks the week before were scary. And actually, the detail from yesterday qualified it and made it all a little less scary. So, for instance, the kind of, my God, if your constituency house is within 60 minutes of London, then you don't get a second home. Well, true, but you'll get £120 to stay in a hotel.
Yeah. No, I think there was definite relief about some of the things. And fury, though, that second jobs were not done away with, because that was the one thing that was seen as being hard on the Tories, which he didn't do for whatever reason. Yeah.
There's an interesting piece in today's paper by David Blunkett, headlined Kelly Simply Doesn't Get It, which gives the kind of parliamentarian side of this. He accuses the civil servant who wrote the report of having a London-centric outlook, which I'm sure might be true, but then gives examples that are meant to evoke some sympathy, Catherine. I wonder what you make of this. First of all, the strange world in which an MP lives in which they get onto a train with the civil servant and their partner, who they employ, is shunted off in second class while they're working away in first class. And then also he points out that when he started in Parliament in the 1980s, before there were big expenses, of course, MPs used to die on average every 3 months because times were so hard. He does clarify it wasn't quite like working down the mine or in a pit. But I don't know. It is extraordinary, I think, that MPs are still writing this stuff, isn't it?
Amazing. I mean, every time one of them tries to sort of, you know, try and sort of awake a bit of pity, it would take a heart of stone not to laugh. I mean, I thought the thing about yesterday where these spouses keep coming forward sort of saying, you know, what if we met and then, you know, are you going to be policing the bedroom and all this kind of stuff? Well, the fact that they, you know, hadn't noticed that theirs is the only job outside small businesses where you can employ a spouse or a son or your mother. It's just staggering, I think.
Go on, defend them. Come on, Jackie, defend.
It's hard. Do you know what I think it is? I mean, I, as journalists, you know, we all have had expenses in the past. And I always remember years ago, I used to get a newspaper allowance, £3 a week it was then, but it bought me every single newspaper every day.
Wow.
That's what times used to be like in ITV. And they took away our newspaper allowance. And I remember feeling terribly aggrieved. And then someone said to me, well, why shouldn't you buy your own newspapers? And I said, because I have to buy all of them. I'm a journalist. And then this friend said, well, so what? You know, you choose to do it. So I sort of thought, yeah, OK, fine. But I think it's that sort of feeling that you've had something and it's taken away from you. And I think, you know, they can't get over that sense that that was mine by right and someone's pinched it off me. Whereas actually, they've just got to look at it, you know, more, as Catherine says in the round, look at other jobs and, you know, in other jobs you don't have these kind of ridiculous perks. And so get real.
Also the lack of connection with what other people earn, I think, is really struggling. Where, you know, Harriet Harman stands, well, we've got to watch out and make sure that you know, only, that in the future we don't have a situation where only rich people can come into politics. And I know that in journalism, maybe 60,000 to some people is not thought to be a vast amount. But, you know, generally speaking, compared for the most population, it's a lot of money and it's a well-paid
job.
Double
the average wage.
And that, I suppose, point brings us back to why it is important to outsource some of these things to other people who are outside the world and to hand power to them. But at this point, we're going to hand our power over to Father Time and call it a day.
Thank you to Jackie Ashley and Catherine Bennett for joining us this week and to Francesca Panetta for producing. Just a very quick plug, we're going to do a live version of one of these on the 9th of December at 7 o'clock, and if you want to come along or you want to put a question in, then go to our blog.
I won't be back next week, but Allegra will.
He's going on holiday. He's trying to burnish his work-life balance, but till then, goodbye.